Welcome to another episode of the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Dusty White, and I'm here with Pastor Bob Thune of Coramdale Church and Pastor Chris Hemmelman of First City Church. On Wednesdays, we sit down to talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life. And today, we're talking about the four tribes on the political right. You notice how we're always sitting down? Like I always say, hey, we sit down to talk about... It's true.
We're not standing up.
Hey, today is Ash Wednesday. And so just want to acknowledge what a great and meaningful day, the beginning of the Lenten season, a time that's more reflective, a time for disciplines of abstinence in the Christian faith. So fasting, prayer, solitude, these things tend to be a season where we're trying to sort of put more emphasis in those areas, both in our own lives and in our church. So happy Ash Wednesday, everyone. And we're going to do a very non-Ash Wednesday thing, which is to talk about politics.
Yeah. On the Wednesday conversation. nothing Ash Wednesday about this episode.
But actually, I think it will be helpful. Again, part of what we try to do on this podcast is just help us make sense of culture. All of us are dwelling in a cultural climate. And one of the most common questions I get as a pastor is, hey, how should we or I think about XYZ that's going on in the world around us? And so this is just an opportunity to do some of that work, to think about four tribes on the political right. This is another Jake Meter piece. We talked about one of his articles last week. We're going to talk about another article this week. What he's doing here is just sort of doing the intellectual work for us to tee up for an observation. And I think this is helpful because I think what most people are wondering right now in America is, hey, what's happening in politics? Like, okay, so Donald Trump's president, you got all these new cabinet secretaries that have recently been appointed, and, you know, there's a majority in the House and Senate that are both Republicans, so we're definitely in a two-year burn here of sort of a Republican-led nation. What's going on in politics? How do we make sense of some of the shifts and changes? And we've tried to do some work on this podcast over the past year to kind of talk about that every once in a while. And this is another opportunity to sort of put some flesh on that. And I think helpfully name for people, hey, here's four sort of tribes you see out there on the political right that I think it's good to be able to name and identify. And hopefully will help you sort of navigate the political landscape we find ourselves in, at least currently. Before we get to that, just wanted to tell a story or two, just personally.
Story time. Let's hear it.
I went to visit my son and daughter-in-law in Oklahoma a couple weeks ago. We took just a quick weekend trip down to Oklahoma. My son is a journalist. He does new media, so like website, Twitter, you know, the whole online stuff. But then he also does a radio show for 3 hours every day. So one of the things I did when I was down there is I just went to the radio studio with him and just like sat there while he does his radio gig. And I realized, actually, doing a podcast is a lot simpler than doing live radio.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they stream they have an app that they stream it on. So, you know, he's doing like live radio, but then it's also streaming and it's also on YouTube. So there's like three platforms happening at once. And I just realized, like, man, I'm really proud of my son. The buttons he's pushing and like, there's a lot of technical know-how to do radio. And I was like, wow, this is pretty fascinating to just watch how this happens. All I do is hit this big record button that turns red, and then we just talk in these microphones and it works.
Easy. Yeah. Is he a sports show?
Yeah, man. It's all, if you're not an Oklahoma Sooners fan, his show is going to be the most boring show that you could ever imagine.
Meanwhile, there's some serious listeners.
If you are a red-blooded Sooner fan, man, this is like the height of your day.
Deep dive.
Thinking about which high school athlete are we recruiting this week? You know, it's that kind of a show.
Crazy. Wow.
Man, but he's doing great, and I'm really proud of him. And you know, he has great job security because there's enough of those people in every major media market that's just like, yep, their advertisers want to get those red-blooded, angry sports fans who are looking for, you know, whatever. So there's good advertising dollars flowing in that direction. But it was really fun to watch him, you know, do the things, push the buttons, and take live phone calls on the air. I'm just like, man, it's a lot of things happening at once.
Which are on the air. So like he's pushing buttons for that too. That's crazy.
Yeah.
So not us.
Made me realize we just run a pretty simple operation.
Pretty simple.
I bet he has sponsors.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, we don't have those.
He has to read ad reads. So there's a whole packet, you know, sitting on the table where it's like, you know, at 12 after the hour, you read this paragraph or this ad, you know. And it just made me realize, you know what we don't do on this show, Chris? Ad reads.
Ad reads at all.
We have no advertisers other than the people who provide our snacks.
No one owns us.
You get a shout out if you bring a snack. Otherwise, we're not saying today's podcast is brought to you by BetterHelp.com. You know, there's no.
I mean, you could argue that I am brought to you by Ricola.
Yeah, you have been working the cough drops lately. Like the last four episodes.
Yeah. Really.
Do we need an intervention?
I don't know. Maybe. It's maybe I need throat surgery or something.
Something, man.
Let me give you now the four tribes on the political right. It's the Silicon Valley right, the Barstool right, Christian nationalism, and Christian civic republicanism. There's your four tribes. Now, I'm going to break those down and tell you a little bit about them. We'll chop it up a little bit. But this is, again, Jake Meter's analysis. You might agree or disagree. Some of you, this is your world. You should write us an email and tell us what you think if there's a tribe or two missing here. But essentially what he's saying in this article is, hey, the left, the political left is in disarray right now. You know, you had kind of the Obama consensus, the sort of classic liberal left, and then you had the more progressive wing of the Democratic Party represented by people like Bernie Sanders and Kamala Harris. All of that is in disarray. Like the whole left is in disarray right now. The Democrats are fighting among themselves. It's not clear whether they're going to continue to go super woke or whether they're going to sort of correct back into a more classical liberal direction. But either way, Jake Meter says, whatever the answer is, it doesn't seem like the future is going to be defined by the left.
Which in my lifetime, I mean, I realize I'm only 45. It seems like this is the first time that that's been the case. Am I right? Where it's been so up for grabs,
yeah, interesting,
on the left.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I guess I would agree with you because I'm thinking, well, you had the George W. Bush era, which was two administrations, but that was a very contested, like, you remember there was like shows on Comedy Central just mocking the entire Bush administration.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the culture was still very heavily progressive.
It still seemed unified,
right?
I guess is my
point. Yeah. Yeah. Makes me wonder sometimes whether it would have been better for Trump to win re-election and them to like hold, but just feel like them elect the left electing Biden just like blew up the party. Like he just lost their way.
Yeah, it really did.
But
so whether you agree with that or not, Jake Meter's perspective is, hey, the next 8 to 12 years are not going to be, you know, unless something really dramatically changes on the left's not writing this script for the next 8 to 12 years. It's probably going to be the more populist right. And so he says the right, the American right kind of has four tribes, four power groups, four different kinds of people vying for power and prestige and policy. And what I like he does here is he basically says, he's going to describe each of these four by asking, what is the world? What is political society and what is it for? What threatens political society and how do you address those threats? So he's just going to give us, these four tribes are going to answer those questions differently. Let me review them real quickly for you, and then we'll just sort of talk about them a little bit. So the Silicon Valley right, this is Elon Musk, Mark Andreessen, Peter Thiel, people like this. You know, this is your, I don't know if you guys, Dusty and Chris, listen to the All In podcast.
But every now and then.
I'm kind of a fan of the All In podcast, but all four of the guys on that podcast are like Silicon Valley investor billionaire guys, and they're so all in on this. They're like, man, one of them is Trump's AI czar right now. Like they're very interesting figures because they have a lot of money. They are very innovative and they think a lot about entrepreneurship and they're very forward looking. They want opportunity. They want us to take advantage of innovation. They want America to be great specifically when it comes to starting companies and funding companies and capitalism and those kinds of things. So here's Jake Meter's four questions. For the Silicon Valley right, what is the world? Well, they would say the world is a rapidly depleting resource which won't be able to sustain the kind of life we want long term. It needs to be subdued to our wishes so that we can overcome its limitations. And for that to happen, great men need to be unleashed to innovate and create. What is political society? What is it for? Political society is a large economic bloc made up of innovators and consumers It exists to facilitate the greatness and ambition of the innovators. What threatens political society? Tyrannical bureaucracy, tired old-fashioned moralism, and fear. And how do you address those threats? Use the hard power obtained through wealth and technology to take control of the institutions suppressing innovation, and instead transform those institutions to be enablers of the innovative class. It is really fascinating for me to read those four things and think about what's happening right now with Elon Musk. One of the wealthiest men in the world. I think he is the wealthiest man in the world. He's working for free for Donald Trump in the White House, just basically like trimming waste, fraud, and abuse from the federal government with a sort of very aggressive strategy of we're going to take control and get rid of bureaucracy. We're going to make things simple. We're going to get rid of bureaucracy. We're going to sort of like some innovative leader needs to take the wheel and fix what's broken in the federal government is kind of how he's approaching. Mm-hmm.
And the amount of time, airtime, spotlight that guy has gotten just in these first few weeks is remarkable compared to any past vice president.
And it's also because the left hates what he's doing so much that there's a news story about it every day. They're like, wait, he did what? He can't do that.
Which they love, which he loves.
He's just
like, yes,
yeah, he just doubles down on it. And so, so you do have this, the Silicon Valley right focus is take control of the institutions and transform them to enable innovation. That's what Musk wants to do. It's what all these guys want to do. So that's the Silicon Valley right. And what I think is probably dangerous about that is those people have a lot of money. So if you ask like who could immediately have influence just because they have wealth and fame, it's all these billionaire entrepreneurs.
And there's ways in which their vibe, for lack of a better term, very much is Trumpian in the sense of like, hey, let's, you know, greatness.
Yep.
Let's, you know, take ground. Let's, you know.
Yeah.
So is it fair to say that, or maybe this is getting a little ahead of ourselves, of the four tribes, that this is probably the one closest to Trump?
Yeah. I mean, they're, you know, he's certainly a great man view of history, and I think these guys would share that.
Yeah.
He definitely likes it.
Yeah.
You know, he likes the
business. They seem to be the in crowd right now.
They want to make deals and build stuff and break things. And, you know. So the second tribe is the Barstool, right? This is Dave Portnoy from the Barstool sports guy. I don't know if you've watched any Dave Portnoy. He's sort of an obnoxious figure.
Only his like really bad pizza reviews.
He's real brash and he's kind of just obnoxious, but he was one of the most visible and vocal critics of COVID lockdowns in America. And so what Jake Meter is pointing out here is that basically there's a bunch of just blue collar human beings all across America who love Dave Portnoy because he was saying what they were all feeling, which is don't tell me I can't leave my house. I got money to make. I got jobs to do. I need to keep living. And so the Barstool conservatives, as Meter calls them, are basically the people who just want to keep living their life. These are sort of like the live and let live people. They're like, hey, you know what? I'm not, I'm against trans ideology because you're telling my daughter's sports team that we have to let a boy play on it. But if you weren't messing with my life like that, I don't really care what you do in your life. Like you can feel free to be whatever you want. Just don't mess with my world. That's kind of the Barstool conservative vibe. And so to go through those same four questions again, what is the world? Well, for the Barstool conservatives, the world is a place of opportunity for people willing to put in the work and effort. What is political society and what is it for? Political society is how a group of people secure each other's access to fair opportunity. What threatens political society? Moralizers who deprive people of their freedom to pursue their dreams, and corrupt bureaucrats who care more about their own comfort than they do about fairness. And how do you address these threats? You refuse to comply, be ungovernable, pursue your goals, and if anyone gets in your way, run them over. You know, this is sort of like the classic, like, just get out of my way. I'm going to do my thing.
I'm going to go live on my own land. And
yeah, don't be a freaking nanny state pansy. Like, you know, we're here to get stuff done. Just get out of my way. Let me do my thing. Chris, thoughts over there, Chris? You're like staring off into the distance.
Yeah, lots of different thoughts, but it is interesting with both of these first two that sort of what they share in common is a kind of a minimal ethic you know, kind of the traditional social conservative kind of concerns that are not really the concerns here.
And these people do not care about traditional marriage. They're sort of a live and let live.
Yeah. Yeah. Very minimalist ethic. And I would say minimalist, I don't know if minimalist is the right word, but just their view of even like human nature and freedom. It's just like, hey, leave me alone and let me do stuff is kind of the principle. And it's like, I think there's good to that sentiment, but I'm like, I don't know if that's enough to build actually a political system on.
It's definitely not robust enough, but it is definitely a lot of males who are like 20 to 28 years old.
Yes, it is.
You know?
Yes, it is.
Which is why the title works, the Barstool Right.
Yep. Yeah.
Okay. The third tribe is Christian nationalism. Now, he's going to define this very particularly. I know that the phrase Christian nationalism gets thrown around so broadly in our culture that it's almost not even helpful. But Jake Meter points out, for Christian nationalists, the key is that nature is sufficient. In other words, God has given us just in nature, in natural law, sufficient truth to govern our political life. So we don't need redemptive truth or specifically Christian teaching in order to live together. We just need to abide by the natural order, the natural law. And so Christian nationalism would say, we just need to abide by a basic theory of human nature and basic natural law. Reading now from the piece, for the Christian nationalist, authentic political life is found in a kind of complacent love one has for one's own, grounded in the shared life, culture, and ethnic background of a community. This means they are obviously quite vigorously anti-woke in ways not unlike the Silicon Valley right and the Barstool right. They also mirror the Silicon Valley right in that they tend to have a fairly hostile relationship to political liberalism. Where it gets interesting is how they would differ on things like abortion. Meter says, the actual power brokers in the Trumpist right, the Silicon Valley right and the Barstool right, do not care about abortion. They are perfectly happy, however, to throw pro-life Christians the occasional bone when it doesn't cost them anything to do so. For example, they're perfectly content for Vice President Vance to speak at the March for Life. Likewise, it is perfectly fine to pardon a number of unjustly imprisoned pro-life activists. However, it is enormously unlikely that this Trump administration will take any steps to ban abortion. So, in terms of political substance, the Christian nationalists don't have any power to actually do the things they want to do. Christian nationalists tend to be very anti-abortion, very pro-life, but they lack the political power right now to actually move the party meaningfully in that direction. And so Christian nationalists aren't influential enough to drive policy, but they also because of their specific understanding of how society should work, they're not old school liberals. They're not sort of a live and let live either. Yeah. And so they're kind of stuck in no man's land here.
Yeah. And for better, for worse of how they view some of that, the way those lines fall, the thing that I think is I like is that at least it's moving us towards a more robust view of human nature.
Exactly.
That I think some of, you know, the Barstool and the Silicon Valley versions don't account for. And so, yeah, I think there's how he defines it here, kind of, you know, some strands of the Christian nationalist movement tend to be ethnocentric in ways that aren't good.
Exactly.
But at least that they're fighting for a robust view of human nature, which I think the conversation needs to move forward in.
Let me read the four questions here. For the Christian nationalist, what is the world? It is a natural order made by God, which man is meant to rule and preserve. What is political society and what is it for? Political society is the bonds that exist between people united by common ways of life, culture, and ethnicity. What threatens political society? Migration patterns and disloyalty to one's own. How do you address those threats? Seize political power and then establish a Christian Caesar that will reward one's friends and punish one's enemies.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, there is this sort of like a Caesarist movement among some on the right that are sort of like, you know, just creates a, basically like grab the steering wheel, drive it hard in our direction, run over our enemies, and that's what we want out of a leader.
So to clarify, Christian nationalism is basically saying, let's take dominion.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, most of these guys would be pretty dominionist, yeah.
Okay. Just getting my ducks in a row over here.
All right, and the fourth tribe, and this is the tribe that Bob Thune would place himself in, Christian Civic Republicanism.
Really? I thought you were totally Barstool.
No, I'm definitely not a Barstool right guy. And I realize Christian civic republicanism is such a big mouthful that what good does it do to even call yourself that?
By doing this, you know that you could be in like 2 years, this could be expired.
Right. Well, here's what I like that Jake Meter's doing. He's a pretty thoughtful political theologian. And what he's saying is, okay, so going back to our podcast from a month or two ago on post-liberalism, Christian civic republicanism is a way of saying we're not going back to like old school liberal democracy. But what we are acknowledging is that we live in a pluralistic society. And so not everybody in society is going to share our worldview. And so the problem with Christian nationalism is you end up having to force a bunch of people who don't share your worldview to like be okay with it. And that's probably not going to work very well in a society that's been devoted to religious, ethical, and social pluralism. Basically, what Christian civic republicanism is just it sees democracy as the method that we use to resolve our differences. So it's, you know, we talked about in that post-liberalism podcast that the problem with liberalism is that it becomes an ideology. It has its own vision of the good. And this idea is just to say, hey, look, we live with a bunch of neighbors who have all kinds of different points of view. And so how do we do that? We give and take with one another. Christian civic republicanism, writes Jake Meter, would say that religious claims must be regarded as acceptable forms of public speech, and religious arguments for public policies are likewise valid and legitimate. On the other hand, contrary to Christian nationalists, Christian civic republicans must accept that their views are not shared by everyone, that the way policies are established is through argument, persuasion, and formal legislative process. And this all means they must be open to compromise and willing to accept that they sometimes will lose a vote. And these conditions apply to everyone, because in a democratic system, everyone is going to lose sometimes. The point here is that Christian civic republicans are not looking for a single meta theory to solve all their political problems, nor do they place all their hope in obtaining absolutized political power. Rather, they focus their efforts around the battles that are necessary and winnable, and they build coalitions most conducive to victory on the issue at hand. And running in the background is a persistent commitment to a broadly egalitarian and personalist ethic that opposes political domination, totalitarianism, and tyranny. So let me read the four questions for this Christian civic republicanism. What is the world? It is a good creation governed by a natural order, but now also a world marred by sin, which makes it difficult for us to recognize the natural order and to do lasting good in the world. What is political society and what is it for? Political society exists to ensure that the unavoidable social relationships we all rely on for our lives are mutually beneficial and delightful. What threatens political society? Well, at root, the great threat is sin. But as it relates to peaceable political life in particular, the greatest threat is forms of sin that tend toward the creation of totalitarian or tyrannical systems that exalt and enrich the few at the expense of the many. How do you address those threats? Through the practice of democratic virtues that cultivate neighborly love and civic trust and facilitate political organization and common action among the people. So you see how this is more of a chastened form of, it's living with Christian conviction, but in a chastened way that just acknowledges, I can't pretend that everybody is going to agree to follow the Ten Commandments. That's the problem with Christian nationalism, is that if I have to force my neighbors to follow the Ten Commandments, I'm just not sure that's what the scriptures would command us to do.
Because it's not authentic anyway.
Right. They're not, they're not following from the heart in the first place. So a civic republicanism just acknowledges, hey, we're living in a pluralistic society. I get my freedom to be a Christian and to bring my Christian values into the public square and to try to persuade you about what's good, true, and beautiful. You're not going to pretend that I can't do that, or you're not going to marginalize me or silence me. But also, I have to realize as a Christian that you might disagree, and I'm going to have to persuade and win arguments and use the democratic process to pass things that are for the common good.
So I asked a similar question when we were going through another post-liberalism article, is what is the difference between this and America 80 years ago?
Great question. Perhaps not much.
Okay. Yeah. It's just, I think that's when I read this, I'm like, hey, this is great in one sense, but is this different, substantially different than maybe what we had in the past? And then I think that raises the question, well, doesn't this just maybe reset the clock and don't we get to the problem, the same problem
no,
over time
again?
No, I don't
think so. And because I think that's why he's using the language of civic republicanism rather than liberalism. Because okay. I think what got us off track is the commitment to liberalism, to freedom as the highest good.
Okay.
Where that took us is like, I got to always be pressing for greater and greater freedoms. And once we got to the 1960s and 70s and 80s, that meant, Chris, can I be free to leave my marriage? Can I be free to change mm-hmm. my gender? Can, you know, just the freedom taken to the nth degree in an individualistic framework takes us to all kinds of disorder.
Okay.
So civic republicanism is going back to that sort of older, more communitarian understanding of democracy that says, we got to live together. It's the American colonies, right? Okay. Hey, we got 13 colonies. This one's Catholic. This one's Congregationalist. This one's, you know, no religious background whatsoever. How do we sort of work together for the common good? And so there is sort of like a classically American understanding of this. But I think what it takes out is that liberal philosophy that says the highest good, Chris, is freedom.
Okay. No, that's helpful. That's a helpful distinction because that was, that's the question is like, what is the limiting factor
right.
that's going to keep us from kind of devolving into that sort of chaos again?
And this is, by the way, this is what Abraham Kuyper and Herman Bavinck, I think, were trying to do in the Netherlands, is to say mm-hmm. we are Christians and we are going to lead and govern with a distinctly Christian flavor, but we also live in a pluralistic country. And so how can we lead and seek to win our countrymen over to Christian principles rather than just sort of top-down mandating, we're all going to be Christians here? And that's I think what they were attempting to do for a few years right around the turn of the 20th century is something in this vein.
So this gives room basically for conscience. I read it as right. this sets up a basic structure for all things, but allows the conscience to be activated.
Right.
Is that too simple?
No, you're exactly right. The freedom of conscience is, I think, the Christian principle. And this is where, when I talk with my Christian nationalist friends or my theonomist friends, this is the thing I want to press with them is, hey, the one thing we all agree, the one thing that separates Christianity from religions like Islam is that we believe conversion has to be freely chosen by the person converting, and you can't force somebody to worship, right? Worship is free. Now, we believe that underneath that, the Spirit of God is at work sovereignly calling people to faith in Christ. But my point is, from a human perspective, mm-hmm. if I can't worship freely, then I can't worship. So Christianity is committed to freedom of conscience. The problem with sort of a more Christian nationalist approach is to say, Chris, we're going to make the Ten Commandments the law of the land, and that means, man, you know what? Adultery is illegal, and you're going to be prosecuted for it. Okay, great. That might be the right thing to do in the eyes of God. The problem is, it forces my neighbor to adopt my frame of reference and my ethics, and it does so without winning him over to it. Mm-hmm. It mandates it. It coerces it rather than winning him over to it. And I think the whole point here is, we want to be persuaders. We want to be people who sometimes we do need to fight for, like, there's right and wrong. But we do have to wrestle with the question of, in a pluralistic world, how do we leave people free in their consciences to come to faith in Christ without us demanding that they do so in order to live in our nation?
Yeah. And I think that's the questions that I have about this moving forward is the role of religion. Is Christianity given a privileged place culturally, if not legally, but culturally, in the sense that we're explicitly building laws around a Christian heritage and value? I mean, you go back to, the colonies, as much difference as that, Catholic and Protestants had, and some of those were violent differences.
Yeah.
They did have a shared culture
yeah.
that allowed them the possibility of democracy to work.
Yep.
Where I think that's another question that I have is part of the challenge that we have, that liberalism that kind of kept pushing freedom more and more and more. You add on top of that a pluralism like we have, and now you have just all these competing voices.
Right.
And so what is going to kind of hem in some of the pluralism or limit some of that? Because otherwise, you get in, and is there going to be something that is actually privileged as far as an ethic? Otherwise, you're going to get, you might be able to democracy a little bit better, but it's still going to be a will of power.
Sure.
And so those are the questions that I have for some of these visions is like, hey, how are we have to privilege something different.
I'd be fine with privileging, for instance, a sort of like classically Judeo-Christian understanding of ethics and morality. I think you're right. You have to say like there's a starting point somewhere.
Yeah.
As long as we're not violating freedom of conscience.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's the important thing is like, hey, you think of particular laws, particular values that are there, that they're kind of shaping the law. And there's a freedom some things, you know, if you break the law, but there's also other pieces of this. It's like, hey, I'm not forcing you to be a Christian and follow all the Christian things, but you also have to understand there is a privileged place here. And that's not, you can't undermine that or it's.
Okay. So let me use a concrete example that will get me in a little bit of trouble perhaps because the live issue in our state right now, maybe you've seen this. There's a group of pastors trying to sort of put forward to the state legislature a legislative agenda to abolish abortion
in
Nebraska.
Yes.
It's a well thought out and the motivation behind it is, hey, if abortion is wrong, if it's murder, then we should outlaw it. I love that from a principle. The way they're going about it is basically just, here's what the Bible says. Therefore, here's the law you should pass. And therefore, because the law you should pass is very robust, we're going to criminalize any woman who has an abortion. We're going to criminalize all abortion facilities. It's basically like it's the maximal approach you would take if everybody writing the laws was like, yes, we're a Christian. We believe the Bible's vision on these things. The problem is we live in a state where we're split right down the middle on that issue.
Mm.
And so from my perspective, if our approach to Christian governance is let's pass a maximally Christian law and hold all of our neighbors now legally responsible for obeying that, even though we haven't won them over to the ethic behind it, all I think we do, now we might do good and save lives. Like there will be substantive goods that come from that. What it will not do is gain us any more actual unity on the question of is abortion right or wrong. Mm. It will just criminalize people who disagree with us. Now, we might say, well, that's the position we've been in for the last 60 years. So, you know, now you're getting yours. And I think that's how some people sort of relate to this. But as I've had conversations with people about this document, my pushback has been, hey, I'm not opposed principally to any of the things that are being written here.
Sure.
I think it's really naive to try to do a bill like this without first doing the work to persuade more of our state that this is the right way to go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you, to sort of do the practical math, you know, if you live in a state where 70 to 80% of the people agree that this should be outlawed, well, that's a little easier to say, yeah, you know what? That's a pretty strong majority. We've done the work of persuasion and now we're going to sort of pass laws that begin to take on the shape of the majority of the people. You can debate it all day, the sort of ethics of like, you know, how do you legislate? I think this is an amazing question in church history that's been bantered around for centuries. But to me, this comes down to, do we lead with law and policy, or do we lead with preaching and persuasion? And I'm just the kind of person that I think the new covenant mandate is to lead with the second. I think we lead with preaching and persuasion. And what you, I think if you ask, like, how did Rome become a Christian civilization? Well, the emperor got converted. And then a lot of things changed. But what happened before the emperor got converted was Christianity took over 10% of the Roman Empire and a bunch of people's neighbors and friends were becoming Christians. And there was really a sort of grassroots groundswell of transformation that led to that kind of social change. So I think these are interesting debates to have, but this is why I would fall in that fourth category of Christian civic republicanism, because I think there is a need for us to acknowledge that we live in a pluralistic world and that's just not going to change.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts, Chris?
No, I'm tracking with you the question, as I said before, like it's just the question is it seems on this other side of liberalism that there has to be a much stronger controlling transcendent value. I mean, if we want to say a Christian value that has a more privileged place in accounting for pluralism and accounting for, hey, we're not trying to force certain things on people, But it has to be more prominent and more controlling, I think, in some ways. Otherwise, we devolve into that liberalism being the highest and kind of pushing more and more for freedom. Or we fall into this really weird back and forth will to power where we're
right.
culturally schizophrenic, where it's for these 4 years, this thing is the law of the land. And these next 4 years, this thing. And we're just like swinging back and forth, back and forth. What is the unifying cultural principle? And I think that's the thing with another, I don't know if critique is the right term, but just like question of the Christian civic republicanism is it assumes a shared culture for that to work.
Yeah.
And that we have to build that. So maybe that's what you're saying, you know, the persuasion of how do we build that in order to operate within a range of democracy and a range of differing opinions and views on things that isn't just this, you know, I think it's just too wide, too big now for various reasons. And so those are just, I think these are just more the questions of like, hey, how are we going to start to build this out?
I think those are where the last two tribes there, the two Christian ones, Christian yeah. nationalism and Christian civic republicanism, have a lot to add to the debate and to sort yeah. of bring those questions to the forefront. Because I think you're exactly right. This is a place where there's lots of work to be done. And my concern is right now what's going to happen is the Silicon Valley right is going to tell us what our ethics are because they have the money and the power.
Yeah.
So they're going to tell you, hey, Chris, yeah. You know what? We want IVF and we want, you know, designer babies because that's maximal personal freedom. Doesn't matter to us if, you know, you Christians would have problems with that. That's like ultimate innovation. It's like letting science drive everything. Let's, you know, let's sort of like design the kids we want.
And also they make a lot of money in the process.
Right. But my point is, the Silicon Valley ethic is a little bit more of a utilitarianism.
Yeah.
And the Christians, Christian nationalists, Christian civic republicans, those of us who sort of want to be in the conversation politically, the thing we have to offer is to ask the question you're asking, which is, hey, what's our unifying principle? What's our shared common good? What is the natural order that we live in?
Yeah.
What does Christianity have to say about that? And is Christianity right? And I think one of my hopes is that as the gospel begins to do its work and as Christians begin to do their work, we win over some of those Silicon Valley types, some of those barstool types, to an understanding of, oh yeah, the baseline sort of Christian ethic is actually a really good thing to build a society on.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you hope guys like Peter Thiel, like, hey, can we up the level here of Christian right. influence? And because yeah, I think you're right in the sense of, hey, the Silicon Valley guys seem to be leading the way right now. Trump's kind of operating with them because of their influence and power and money. But I will say, you know, there it seems to be that kind of the Christian voices have Trump's ear, and so he's not hostile and stiff arming. So it gives, but it is going to be a slow rebuild because we will push in ways ethically. I think culturally and understanding of human nature, they're going to push against guys like Elon Musk. And I think that is a very important conversation that we need to have. And so it is interesting times, but I think what I'm, as I think about this more and more, I just think maybe one of the burdens I have is that we don't settle because, hey, all this, you know, we're pushing back against wokeness and there's been some good along those lines. And we have these, you know, the Silicon Valley and the barstool types that are pushing it back against some of this madness that was happening, but it can't stop there. We can't just be, oh, that's not a problem anymore. We're good. You know, Trump's our guy or these guys, Elon's blowing up the government and we're happy with that. And it's like, hey, as much as there might be some good in that, we have to have a bigger vision of society and human nature and community if we're going to actually build something that doesn't just slowly devolve back to where we were.
Yes. The one final piece I'll add would be this, to go back to something I think you said last week on the podcast, Chris. You know, the kingdom of God is always upside down. And so I am not a post-millennialist, which means I actually don't believe that ever 90% of America is going to say, Jesus is our king. Yeah. Let's build our country around his view of the world. So I think as Christians, we need to embrace, like, we're always going to be a minority. And there's never going to be an earthly ruler
yeah.
who says, man, you know what I'm all in for is everything Jesus wants me to be it for. So now I hope we get more and more of those kinds of leaders in our national politics.
Maybe your uncle should run for president.
Yeah, that maybe so. I mean, yeah. You know, that'd be great. But I think that the tension we have to live in as Christians is to say we're actually always living for a world that is not yet. And so there's always a need for us to accept the best approximation of what we can get in this world. And sort of to your point, there's a way we can be over idealistic, I think, about, man, what if we could just build a country, you know, in ways that sort of like very Christianized. And I would like to be able to do that. But I think that as Meter defined Christian civic republicanism, you remember he said, you know, what is the world? It's a good creation governed by a natural order, but also marred by sin. And so that sort of creation plus fall is the thing we have to keep in mind, that we're always working. I guess I would say it this way. The thing that the Christian nationalists get right is the natural order is what we have to work with our neighbors, right? The redemptive order is come to faith in Jesus. But what we have to share with our neighbors is human nature, the natural order of things, the world of reality that God has created. How do we maximize the shared sense of that reality to build a political system? So these are the four tribes on the political right. Thanks for spending your Ash Wednesday with us thinking about politics. I hope what this does at least is to give listeners a sense of what some of the major conversations may be over the next 4 to 8 years within the political right. And if you're a more left-leaning listener, which perhaps you are, you know, I'm curious to see like what comes of sort of the chaos of the Democratic Party right now, because it does seem like there's work to be done there to achieve some vision of what they should be about. So I'm interested to see where that ends up as well. But at the very least, this is, if we're in America, these are some of the players that we'll be thinking about and talking about over the next season of time. And as Christians, I hope this helps us at least navigate some of these conversations in a more intelligent way.
The goal of this podcast is to equip our own church for discipleship and mission. So if you're a Christian or a church leader in another context, thanks for listening in. And we pray that this conversation might be helpful to you as you minister in your context. And we always love to hear from listeners. So if you have thoughts, questions, future podcast topics, send us an email at podcast@cdomaha.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time for another episode of the Wednesday Conversation.